Today on Against the Grain, the United States fancies itself an exceptional nation, and in terms of its media system, it's right. The U.S. has the most commercialized press of any advanced industrialized country, with the least support for public media. So argues critic Victor Picard in his study of the political economy of U.S. journalism. I'm Sasha Lilly. He joins me to talk about the long roots of commercialized media in this country, which for over a century and a half has put profits over public service. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. The dismal state of the media, especially since the turn of the 21st century, has been the subject of much spilled ink. Yet the source of the crisis is often laid at the feet of technology, and of social media in particular. Yet in Democracy Without Journalism, Confronting the Misinformation Society, which is published by Oxford University Press, Victor Picard suggests that the current crisis is not primarily caused by technological change, but rather is part of a longer crisis of the commercial media model, which has predominated in the U.S. since the 19th century. Picard argues that how we explain the decline of journalism has everything to do with how we seek to remedy that decline, or not remedy it, as the case may be. He's associate professor at the Annenberg School for Communications at the University of Pennsylvania and is co-director of the Media Inequality and Change Center there. Victor, perhaps this is an obvious question, but what's the most glaring evidence that the media is in crisis?
There's so much evidence. It's hard to point to one thing in particular. And I think especially since the 2016 election of Donald Trump, a number of structural pathologies were revealed, but many of these problems were very long-standing. The one that I would normally point to that we're starting to hear more about is just the simple loss of journalism. Since 2000, newspaper newsrooms have been reduced by about 50% or more. So what you're seeing are the rise of news deserts across the country where entire geographic regions are losing any local news production whatsoever. About 2,000 newspapers have gone under in the last 15 years. And what this means is that many communities have access to no local news. They don't know what's going on in their backyards, at the local school board meetings. And this is creating what should be seen as a national crisis. So that would be Exhibit A, I believe, to see that our media system is in crisis when journalism is not happening. Original reporting is not happening. So it might seem like there's plenty of commentary in our news media. People are increasingly getting information from social media, but we're having less actual news.
You make the argument that the pathologies, as you've called them, are much more longstanding than a lot of the analysis of the media tends to point to. But I wanted to ask you about the 2016 elections, which was a marker, a place where a lot of critics saw the dysfunction of the media system at work. How would you describe what was apparent then to you? And would you say, as quite a few commentators have, that the dysfunction was particular to television news and social media?
I think it's understandable that that's where attention tends to focus. And in many cases, that's where the problems are most visible. The notorious quote that I always trot out in these conversations is one by the now disgraced former CEO of CBS, Les Moonves, who, when describing the Trump campaign, said, you know, it might be bad for America, but it's damn good for CBS. That was his exact quote, damn good for CBS. I almost titled my book with that phrase. And I just think it captures so much of what's wrong with our media system, and what was so clear in the run-up to the 2016 elections, where especially television news media would sensationalize and trivialize the elections. And obviously there's well-documented evidence showing that there was far more coverage of Donald Trump than any of the other candidates. But what was also more especially damning were content analyses that showed even our elite print media, like the New York Times, those outlets also were not covering policy issues in any substantive way. So really, it was a media failure across the board. And of course, we've all heard a lot now about the incredible amounts of misinformation and disinformation that were being circulated through social media. So that is also another structural pathology. But as you already noted, I mean, in many ways, these are simply symptoms of long-standing problems. Arguably, Donald Trump himself is a symptom of long-standing maladies in our media and political systems. And that's what I'm trying to do in my work. I think we need to do this more often, is to really look at the structural roots of these problems, to get beyond the surface-level media criticism and figure out what are the logics of our media system that drive this coverage.
And we're going to spend much of this hour talking about those deeper roots and the structural elements. But just staying with the present and recent years, staying with the election 2016, and then, of course, right now, we are caught up in the extended election cycle for the next set of elections. And I wanted to ask you about the dimension of injecting drama that not just the more sensationalistic television outlets involve themselves in, but also print media, creating a drama around the horse race between different candidates and who's going to win, and polls show this and then polls show that, rather than focusing on the policies that those different candidates subscribe to. What do you think drives that, and how significant do you think that approach is for an informed public at the time of these elections?
Well, I think it's very significant. And scholars within my field have been debating this for decades, the extent to which media have an effect on public opinion. I think at the very least, we can safely say that the way that campaign coverage is constructed, the way that they cover these elections, helps set the parameters for the range of debate. So in other words, it oftentimes signals what the questions are. You know, what should we be looking at? What are the main differences between these candidates? And as you noted, too often you get what's often referred to as the horse race coverage. You know, who's up, who's down? What are the polls telling us now? What insult did one candidate hurl at another? What gaffe did one candidate make? What clothes, especially for female candidates, you know, what are they wearing? These are the kinds of issues that so much of our news media focus on, instead of looking at the nuts and bolts of policy positions. And without being overly reductive, it's pretty clear why this is happening. In many ways, this sort of conflict-driven news coverage, that's what grips our eyeballs. That's what keeps us glued to the screen. That's what causes us to sit through advertising. And that's the main driver of all of this news media. It's a commercial system. It's profit-driven, and it primarily makes money from delivering audiences to advertisers. And one way, probably perhaps the best way of doing that, is to frighten us, or to sensationalize things, to have drama. And that's why we get so much reality television-like coverage of our politics and of important social issues. And we're seeing this today with the coverage around Donald Trump. Unfortunately, it seems like we didn't learn lessons from the 2016 elections, and news media are doing the same thing.
You write that the United States is unusual in comparison to other similar industrialized countries for having such a commercialized media system. I wanted to ask you, what are the roots of that system? How far back does it go?
I think that's such an important question, because again, far too often in our media criticism, we're kind of reacting to what we're seeing in front of us. And it's often difficult to step back and imagine, you know, how could this have gone differently? There's a sort of lazy narrative that the media simply give people what they want. If you look at the history behind this and you trace it back, and I do this in my current book, but I also did this in my previous book when I was trying to trace back the origins of the commercial media system in the United States. And what you actually see is that there was not consensus. It's not like this was the system that people necessarily wanted. It's rather the system that media corporations wanted, that publishers, commercial publishers and broadcasters wanted. And if we're going to look at our print media, the dawn of commercialization happened in the 1800s. It was a long process. It's especially peaked in the late 1800s when you had the penny press. Many of us have heard of that before, but when there was this shift from relying on a partisan press model, which was subsidized by the political parties, to an advertising-driven model. And that's really where you see the dawn of commercial journalism, and you see this emphasis. Even back then in the late 1800s, early 1900s, there was a lot of concern around what we would call clickbait today, that basically these publishers were trying to bait readers to read their advertisements, and that's how they were making their money. So that's where it begins with print media, and of course commercial broadcasting is a little more recent, 1930s and 1940s.
And obviously skipping over a whole lot of history, and we'll return to some of that history, the model that was set in place, although it has taken somewhat different forms, but you argue that for 150 years we've had a model of media that is based on advertising revenue funding the media system. Can you remind us how that started to come apart in more recent decades?
Yes, and I think something that you mentioned here is a key point that I want to underline. The fact that it has been around for so long, this advertising revenue dependent model of print news media in particular, but also much of our broadcasting media, it almost seems like the natural order of things. You know, it's very difficult for us to think of models outside that paradigm, but it didn't have to be that way. And it just so happens in the U.S., roughly 80% of newspapers' revenues came from advertising. The other 20% came from subscribers and other sources. And this is different from a lot of newspaper industries around the world. Ours was especially reliant on advertising revenue. And so when advertisers and readers shifted to the web, as they've done in recent years, this model essentially fell apart. And that's largely because digital advertising pays pennies to the dollar of traditional print advertising. And that is really the core problem right there when we talk about the journalism crisis. However, the sort of lazier narrative that you'll often hear about this is that the internet broke journalism. And I think that's the wrong way of framing this. It's the wrong emphasis, when it's really more this structural vulnerability that our newspapers were so reliant on advertising revenue, not to mention that many of them were also over-leveraged. Many of them had been involved in buying sprees. And I think media concentration is another contributing factor to this journalism crisis. But if you really want to put your finger on the core structural problem with our news media system, it has been this over-reliance on advertising revenue.
Well, I wanted to ask you a bit more about something that you just mentioned, which is the explanation, which is a very commonplace one, that the internet has killed professional journalism, the internet has killed traditional media. And of course, there are those who think that's not a bad thing and others who bemoan what has been lost. But when a technology is given the blame for deep changes in society, is there not the danger that these things end up seeming inevitable, that technology is somehow, you know, the progress of invention and technology and innovation, this is sort of the march of history, and that political decisions, social decisions are not involved in those processes?
Yes, that is such a problem. We might think of it as technological determinism, or in cases where people are celebrating these technological changes, we often hear the phrase technological utopians. And this does misunderstand the core nature of how these changes occur. They don't just happen to us. These technologies don't just operate detached from human agency. This is more a direct result of policy actions, or rather, in many cases, inaction. And I think we should understand this as political choices that are driven by economic imperatives more often than these technological changes. And that's not to say that there aren't important technological disruptions that occur, and certainly the internet counts as an enormous one. But I think it really misplaces the emphasis on how we should be viewing the crisis. And to go back to this idea of, you know, our news media being so dependent on advertising revenue, another way of looking at that is that advertising in many ways was a subsidy. You know, the advertisers themselves very rarely cared about the news media per se. They were trying to reach audiences, and the best way of doing that, especially in the heyday of monopoly one-town newspapers, that it was to advertise in your print, local print media. And they basically had access to these monopoly markets. But that model, again, has completely fallen apart, and advertisers never really cared whether we had foreign bureaus set up, or if local politics were being covered adequately. And so now, basically, we don't have a way to support the news media that our democracy requires. And this is a policy problem. And that's how I'm trying to frame it in my book, to really set this up as something where we need policy interventions to try to solve the journalism crisis.
Victor Picard is my guest. We're talking about his book, Democracy Without Journalism? Confronting the Misinformation Society. He's associate professor at the Annenberg School for Communications at the University of Pennsylvania. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So tell us what it looked like when the advertising revenue fell, when these changes took place to the funding, the subsidization of the media system. What did it look like in terms of the kind of journalism that was possible after that point?
You first see a spike in this crisis. And again, I try to show that this is a long historical pattern. I think in some ways you can say that journalism has always been in crisis, or at least those structural vulnerabilities have always been there. Mm-hmm. And we've seen moments throughout history. We saw with the panic around yellow journalism in the early 1900s. You know, we see these crises reoccur throughout history. But the most recent one, I think, really flared up in around 2008, which coincided with the global financial crisis. And that's when suddenly you saw thousands of newspaper jobs in particular vanish almost overnight. You saw the Rocky Mountain News newspaper in Denver close. You saw the Seattle PI paper close. These long-standing papers going belly up. And that was when there was a kind of panic. I was actually living in Washington, D.C. at that time. And it was a really rare moment where you saw status quo assumptions about news media in particular, but about the economy in general, really thrown into flux. You saw a lot of questioning, and you saw things that you almost never see. You saw policymakers turning to historians. They were essentially parachuting historians into Washington, D.C. for congressional hearings to try to figure out, you know, how did this happen? Have we ever dealt with these things before in our history? And so you had this rare window where it seemed like we would start looking for structural alternatives to our commercial news media system. And, you know, without keeping your listeners in suspense, you know, we know that that window closed very quickly. But it just showed you how quickly things can change overnight, that suddenly these longstanding assumptions about, you know, whether we must have a commercial media system or whether we should be looking for nonprofit alternatives, those questions suddenly came into visibility, And I think that's an important lesson for us to keep in mind now as we try to look for structural alternatives.
The crisis that you're describing obviously was very acute, and as you pointed out, there's great bloodletting that took place in news outlets all over the country. But in the middle of that crisis, there were some voices hearkening back to a golden age of journalism that had taken place in the past. Some might locate it in the 1970s, where journalists did the important work that kept American society democratic, and news outlets like the Washington Post were celebrated. And I just wonder if, when you say that commercial media in many ways has always been in crisis in the US, how should we think from the vantage point of the present, where journalism looks in complete disarray around us, how should we understand the decades prior to this most recent crisis? And are some people looking at it through rose-colored glasses?
I think that's an important point, and it's one that we have to keep in mind, that there really, we should not think in terms of a golden age that was lost that we must reclaim. And we have to remember that this golden age was a time when communities of color were not being covered or were being misrepresented. It was really a golden age for rich white men primarily. And not to mention that there were only three major television networks. So this is certainly not a time that we want to reclaim. And one way I look at it is that when you had this time where there was more investigative journalism occurring, one way of seeing that is seeing it as a kind of positive externality to these commercial exchanges. I mean, whenever you have publishers making tremendous profits, then they might be a little more generous towards funding the kind of expensive journalism that we'd like to imagine newspapers are always doing, the investigative reporting, local journalism, international coverage, for example. These things cost a lot of money. But I don't think we should assume that there was this time where things were completely harmonious, and instead we should try to think in terms of trying to reimagine what our news media could be, to make sure that our newsrooms look like the communities that they're serving, and that they're going to where the silences are, that sort of romanticism that many of us have always thought of when we thought of the Fourth Estate.
There are those who would argue that the upheavals of the past two decades is part of the cycles of creation and destruction that fuel innovation, and that so as an old form goes, a new one rises to take its place. Why do you think that take on what's happening in the media now, that more positive take on the recent crisis of media, misses the mark?
Well, I think that sort of rhetoric, those discourses of creative destruction and even perfect storms, sort of cast the journalism crisis as a natural occurrence. And I think, again, that's the wrong way of looking at this, of framing it, the wrong way of understanding what, again, is the result of social constructions and policy decisions and indecisions. So to call it a kind of, creative destruction makes it seem like, there's this disruptive innovation occurring, and we just need to sort of step out of the way and let technologies do their thing, and something new and better will emerge from the chaos. And, that really takes the responsibility away from those who are exacerbating the journalism crisis. It takes responsibility away from policymakers. It also takes our own agency away. It makes us seem like, we're just passive victims to this march of history. And I think instead we need to look at it as something that we must intervene in, and that our democracy depends on it. I mean, we're already seeing on almost a weekly basis, a new study comes out showing us what happens when a local newspaper closes, when people don't have access to local journalism. People are less informed about politics. They're less civically engaged. They're less likely to vote. We're also finding that there's less accountability and a rise of corruption and mismanagement in local government. So there are all these social harms, these negative externalities that occur when we lose local journalism. And I just don't think we should see this as the natural growth of technology or, you know, an economic shift. This is a national crisis, and it's something that we must intervene in.
I don't think we hear this argument so much now, but about a decade or 15 years ago, there was almost a sort of left take on the idea that as the old disappears, the better new will take its place. And that was from people who were, I would say rightly, critical of the traditional media system, but then argued that new technologies, new structures were allowing for citizen journalists to take the place of slanted traditional journalism, and that a whole army of citizen journalists would kind of rise up and it would usher in a kind of a new era of fantastic journalism. How do you see that argument, which, as I say, I think has waned?
Yes, it has waned, and I think there's a reason for that, which is there's been very little evidence that such an idea would come to fruition. And I think it's understandable. You know, there's no question that our media, more often than not, have been complicit in everything from the run-up to the Iraq War, to the events leading to the financial collapse in 2008. Our media are often essentially status quo managers. And I think there's an understandable left-wing critique that suggests we should just let them burn, you know, let the dinosaurs die and something new will emerge. At the very least, something better will happen compared to what we've had. But this is where, again, I think it's so important to get back to these structural roots of what's wrong with our commercial media system. And I really want to underscore that word commercial, because many of these problems can be traced back to the commercial imperatives that drive so much of our news media system. And if we remove those imperatives, if we let journalists be journalists, if do the things that we've always heard that they're supposed to do, I think we would see a very different media system take root. And I think we can dare imagine, I mean, to use the cliche, this crisis should also be seen as an opportunity to entirely reinvent journalism.
Victor Picard is my guest. We'll return with him after this music break. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly. Today I'm speaking with Victor Picard. He's associate professor at the Annenberg School of Communications at the University of Pennsylvania. He co-directs the Media Inequality and Change Center there, and he's the author of Democracy Without Journalism, Confronting the Misinformation Society, which is published by Oxford University Press at againstthegrain.org. You can find a link to that book. His other books include America's Battle for Media Democracy. So you're arguing that although the media system has deep problems, and these deep problems are nothing new, that they are rooted in the highly commercial nature of American media, which goes back a century and a half, that despite the problems with this media system, seeing professional journalism fall apart today hasn't benefited those who would like to see a more equitable and just media system. And I wanted to ask you particularly about what has been at stake with the loss of print journalism and the transformation of print journalism. You know, there's obviously a lot of attention about cable television and social media and the ways that both of those have amplified misinformation and moved the focus away from some of the key questions. With all its flaws, why does print journalism matter?
So it might seem counterintuitive, especially since so much of our conversation has been focusing on how our media have failed us and how print journalism in particular is disappearing. But even in its beleaguered state, our newspaper industry is the primary generator of original reporting for our entire news media system. So even though our newspapers are dying, you're hearing phrases not just of news deserts, but ghost newspapers, very colorful narrative metaphors are coming into the discourse, trying to describe what's happening as newspapers are hollowed out and shuttering across the country. But even in this state, they are still the ones that are producing original reporting that then gets cycled through our social media. Television media is often simply taking cues from print media. So, you know, this is why it's still so important that it is the last bastion of actual journalism in our entire news media landscape. But I also would want to step back, and this goes to some earlier things we were talking about in our conversation, about how the U.S. media system in many ways is exceptional and not exceptional in a good way. Mm-hmm. It's in a category of its own, largely because, as you noted, it is so commercialized with very few public alternatives. And that's where the U.S. is literally off the charts for how little money we allocate towards our public media. Per person per year, we spend about $1.40 towards our public media. And if you compare that to other leading democracies around the world, where, for example, Britain, where I'm living now, the BBC gets about $100 per person per year. Northern European countries will spend well over $200 per person per year. So we've maintained a very impoverished public media system. And that, again, is why our newspapers are so important. We don't have this kind of public safety net for when the news fails, for when the market fails to support the news that our democracy requires. And this really creates even higher stakes that we preserve our actual journalism that's occurring at newspapers today.
What role do you think social media plays in the dysfunction that you're talking about, and how much of that dysfunction is related to how commercial social media is?
Well, I think social media deserve all the criticism and scrutiny that they're receiving right now. We're certainly well aware of all the charges of misinformation that are being amplified, especially through Facebook. And I think this is a healthy response that there's growing criticism. But I think we're often missing some of the core problems, which is that even though there is so little money being generated by digital advertising compared to traditional print advertising, what money that is being generated online is going almost entirely to the duopoly of Facebook and Google. So not only are they creating all these social harms by amplifying misinformation and disinformation and hate speech, but they are also gobbling up all the financial sustenance online that otherwise might go to the news media, from which they're often, these social media platforms are often profiting from the actual news media producers. So I think this is part of the problem too that we need to look at. And this is also why I've argued that these digital monopolies like Facebook should be putting money towards a public media fund to try to help support the journalism that society requires.
Can you think of examples of social media elsewhere that is publicly funded?
I wish I could. That would be very convenient to have models that I could point to. I mean, obviously there are strong public media systems in almost every democracy on the planet. But in terms of social media, we, in many cases, we have what are called network effects, where these commercial models are already so large. I mean, Facebook has almost 2.5 billion users right now. So it's very hard at this point to create a public alternative, although some people are arguing for that. I certainly think that should be part of the conversation. Some people have suggested that we have a BBC model for social media. But when you have these path dependencies and where there are already so many people already hooked into this commercial model, it's difficult to imagine a scenario where we could create a new platform from scratch, but certainly worth trying.
Well, let's talk about alternatives to the media system. You argue in Democracy Without Journalism, and you've been arguing in this hour, that while it seems almost natural for the media system in the United States to be commercial and advertising dependent, as that falls apart, it's a reminder to us that actually there's nothing natural about that, and that there are other ways that the media could be funded and structured. And so I wanted to ask you about a number of the different approaches that have been bandied about since journalism experienced and the media system has experienced its most recent crisis, especially around funding. One way that listeners are undoubtedly familiar with that media outlets have responded to the crisis of disappearing advertising funding is to set up paywalls. How successful have those been? That is, of course, that if you know you want to read the Wall Street Journal online, you're going to have to pay to do so. How successful has that model been, and how do you see it as an alternative to what has come before?
So you're absolutely right that that's one of the first alternatives to the advertising model that people will turn to, the paywall model, the online subscription model. And you know, it's a little bit of a mixed bag because there are some outlets that have been able to use this successfully. But if you really look at those that have been able to do so, they tend to be the very large national or even international news organizations. It's really the big three, the Washington Post, New York Times, Wall Street Journal. And then you also might find smaller niche outlets that are reliant on a kind of membership model. But beyond that, the paywall model is really not panning out for most newspapers. And this includes big city metro dailies. So that really is not a sustainable model for most news organizations. And I've been trying to push us away from focusing on that. You know, the other model that you already mentioned is this idea of citizen journalism that we would all we all have access to cell phones. We all can be journalists, amateur journalists. But again, that has begun to fade a little bit. It just so happens that we recently hit the 20-year anniversary of the Independent Media Center or Indie Media model. And you know, something that came out of the late 1990s, early 2000s. And that's an ideal that I think we might want to try to recover. But if we could find a way to subsidize local newsrooms, I think that would be the best approach to the journalism crisis.
How do you see crowdfunding in that? That's something that has become popular in recent years. People appealing to, well, often their friends, but people around them to support a venture.
Yes, and I would put crowdfunding in a similar category as even, you know, the kind of the paywall, I guess is a blend of the paywall model and the citizen journalism model, where again, it might work for groups of people, small groups. It might be able to fund a few journalists here and there. And given our current crisis, I think we should embrace anything that seems to work, that seems to support any level of journalism, but we have to be clear that this is not a systemic fix. Another major model that's often trotted out is the foundation model, or the rich benefactor, sometimes referred to as the benevolent billionaire model. And, you know, this has been successful in some cases here and there. It begs the observation, of course, that not all billionaires are benevolent, and sometimes they might use news outlets as their political playthings. But again, this is not a systemic fix. Even if we can point to some very successful models like ProPublica or Texas Tribune or Voice of San Diego, MinnPost, there's some great nonprofits out there, or in some cases, they're sort of hybrid models. But this does not, this is not a structural solution. This would not support the level of journalism that our democracy requires.
Well, not to put you on the spot, but what about the model that was championed by Pacifica Radio, the model of sponsorship by those who choose to fund something, but different than a subscription in that you can access it without subscribing?
Yes, I think there are some great models, and I want to find a way so that we have hundreds of Pacificas. But in many cases, relying on individuals is not enough of a support system. And in many cases, there are also subsidies. I believe even Pacifica gets some federal subsidies from the CPB, if I'm not mistaken.
Or has in the past, is trying to get it again, yes.
Okay. But, you know, too often this isn't enough, or it might support, you know, small outlets. But what I'm calling for in my book would be massive subsidies, so that we really could have a new public media system that can withstand these market failures. And I really think that's the last best hope for journalism. We need to find a way to have public investments, to see journalism as a public good that will never be supported by the market, and we could never expect individuals to entirely support it. So that would be my argument, my response. But at the same time, there are these other experiments that are occurring, and I think that actually gives me a weird sense of hope despite the otherwise dire crisis that we're all facing right now.
I should say I'm speaking with Victor Picard. He is associate professor at the Annenberg School of Communications at the University of Pennsylvania. We're talking about his book, Democracy Without Journalism, and that has a question mark on it, Confronting the Misinformation Society. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So let me ask you about the model that you are championing in Democracy Without Journalism, and that is of a public media option. What would that look like?
It's a great question, because it's very hard to imagine what that might look like. But at the very least, I would argue that it has to be well-funded. And when we first launched public broadcasting in the late 1960s, we initially had hoped that we'd place a tax on television sets to help fund that. That was the original blueprint for public broadcasting. And if we had done that, we might have had something more like a BBC model, something that would be not just well-funded, but not not reliant on the appropriations process. So, you know, there's this constant political pressure on our public broadcasting today to not be, you know, too edgy, too confrontational. And, you know, we could have ended up with a system where there was enough money, enough funding, so we could have the kind of adversarial, hard-hitting journalism that we really need as a democratic society, or as a society that tries to be democratic. And, you know, so I think that is step one. Step two is to make sure that it is run and even owned by the journalists themselves, as well as local communities, and that local communities are involved with each layer of this public media system, from governance to infrastructure to actual news making. And I mentioned the indie media model earlier. I think in our ideal world, we would have citizen journalists, but they would be well paid to do what they should be doing, and that is gathering original news on a daily basis. So those are just some of the characteristics. I go into more detail in the book, of course. And then in many ways, I'm also just trying to start this conversation, because I don't think we could have all the answers until we really get local communities involved in this process.
You are in London right now, and you mentioned the BBC, and what you're talking about seems like, and you call it this, a social democratic solution. And I wanted to ask you about the problems that state media have had in places like the UK with the BBC, with the complexities of being dependent on the state for funding. Certainly, there were a whole number of criticisms leveled against the BBC during the Iraq War for the BBC not being critical enough of the UK state.
It is true. This concern always comes up, and it's a very legitimate concern that public broadcasting or public media systems that are dependent on state funding, that somehow they might become mouthpieces for whatever government happens to be in power. And there are safeguards that we can build in that many democratic societies have successfully put in place to prevent that from happening, to prevent that sort of capture from occurring. And I address this a little bit in the book about how we could set up various double blind systems, and making sure that, you know, even though these media outlets would be publicly subsidized, they would not be controlled by any government. And I think that's a key starting point that we could never compromise on, that they would have to be independent, publicly funded media outlets. And the BBC certainly has many faults, although at times, even during the Iraq War, at times it was actually quite adversarial compared to some other news outlets. But at the same time, you're absolutely right. Even now, during these elections, all my British friends are really hating on the BBC. It has not been very impartial, and it seems to be very biased towards the status quo and towards the Tories in particular. So I think those are very legitimate concerns, but we can build in structural safeguards.
How do you think the U.S. could come to the place of embracing a public media system? There's such a very deep market-based ethos, and even the public media that exists, like NPR, is really tangled up with commercial interests as well through underwriting. How could you imagine such a system coming into place? Are there steps that you could see along the way?
Well, I don't think it's going to happen tomorrow, and certainly I don't think it will happen during the Trump administration. But you are seeing a slow but sure shift towards this recognition that the market is simply not going to support the level of journalism that we need. And because of that, even for people who might otherwise be ideologically against the notion of a publicly subsidized media system, I do think we're going to see more experimentation and more shifts in that direction. And you're already seeing that. You saw that with New Jersey deciding to allocate, initially it was $5 million. It's been reduced, but they're going to put a significant amount of money towards subsidizing local journalism. You're also seeing just polling across the board, across the political spectrum. People tend to like and trust their local media, and they also tend to like public media, believe it or not. Even among conservatives, they tend to be more open towards public broadcasting than people would otherwise assume. So I think those various data points suggest that there can be a move towards this, but it's going to take a lot of political organizing, a lot of political work to make it happen.
Well, let me end by asking you about that precisely. In the early 2000s and the late 1990s, there was a whole upsurge of interest in the media and mass media activism. It was something that many activists championed as a central issue. Where do you see the status of media activism today? And do you think that there is the potential for it to head in the direction you're talking about?
I do, and I sort of mentioned this earlier in the conversation, that I do have a weird sense of optimism right now that although things might get worse first, that ultimately we are moving towards a future, especially among young people. You see it, that they're not as enthralled to market fundamentalism. They're more open-minded towards these kind of social democratic, even socialist alternatives. And I think increasingly there's also a recognition that regardless of what your first primary political issue might be, media has to be a secondary concern. We're obviously not going to get very far whether we're talking about global warming or hyper inequality or whatever huge social problem we're trying to address. We're going to need an open and democratic media system to make any sort of progress on that issue. And I think that that activists today and social movements today recognize that, and that gives me some hope.
Victor Picard, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Sasha.
Victor Picard is the author of Democracy Without Journalism, Confronting the Misinformation Society. That's published by Oxford University Press on againstthegrain.org. You can find a link to that book. His other books include After Net Neutrality and America's Battle for Media Democracy. Victor Picard is associate professor at the Annenberg School for Communications at the University of Pennsylvania, where he co-directs the Media Inequality and Change Center. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.